Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion on current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and joining me today are Jeremy Goldhorn, the man behind DinoWay.com. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening to you, Kaiser.
And Gadi Epstein, correspondent for The Economist. How are you, Gary?
Gary Steingart.
I'm doing well, whatever identity I am. Okay. I can do Gary Steingart.
Give the wine a little one.
Okay.
Today, we are talking about the U.S. elections, the Sparta selection. Sparta. This is Sparta! And whatever the recent topics happen to strike our fancy, like maybe Jeremy Page's piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago that seems to confirm that Neil Haywood was indeed a spook, supplying intelligence to his handlers at MI6 on Bo Xilai and family. And anyway, just a warning to those accustomed to a little more structure in the podcast. Today we're going to fly by the seat of our pants. And so let's just see what happens here. But let's start with the American election. Obviously, there would be a lot more to talk about with respect to how the election impacts U.S.-China relations had Governor Romney won. But of course, Obama's re-election still has a certain significance. Outwardly, Beijing has, of course, congratulated President Obama on his re-election. But how does the Chinese leadership, if one can generalize, feel about this? Are they relieved? Are they disappointed? Was Beijing secretly hoping for a replay of Florida? And
I think that they were impressed with how the administration orchestrated the 2012 American Congress, American Party Congress. I think they always expected that the current administration would just appoint itself to succeed itself.
Well, didn't they?
I think we'll have to. I Romney didn't endear himself to the Chinese leadership with his whole, I'll declare them a currency manipulator on day one and running against China and all the way up to the end of the campaign with that Jeep ad in Ohio. I think they don't love Obama either. But
I think, the Chinese government and, for example, Chinese landlords, the thing they hate most about foreigners is their unpredictability. And a new administration would be unpredictable.
Right. So this is continuity. So, I mean,
continuity is always good.
Of course, a new guy is always, when Obama came in, they were able to get about a year of, shiny, happy honeymoon.
Right.
And maybe, new guy also could. They're used to the new guy coming in and maybe moderating a bit. So I don't think they were necessarily,
terrified of Romney. Yeah, they knew, as everyone else did, that he was a barefaced liar. So that his words about currency manipulation
might have been,
meant nothing.
Were following Nate Silver as well and knew that Obama had a very strong chance of winning.
Yeah, they knew that he was going to win the election, Mr. Silver. How would you guys characterize popular Chinese reactions to the election? I mean, I'm sure we've all talked to our Chinese friends and acquaintances and read some of the online reaction. What was popular reaction to the election all about? I mean, given that this is happening at the same time.
Well, there seemed to be a fair bit of support for Obama. I've also noticed both on Weibo and in conversation people saying that they thought Romney was a better guy for one reason or another. There's the usual joking about, the fact that Americans do actually have democracy. So the joke that repeats itself every few years is about how you poor Americans, you have to wait so long to find out who your president is going to be.
Right.
We knew who our next president would be 3 years ago. That joke resurfaces every time there's an American election.
Wait, you sort of offhandedly said on Weibo you seemed to think that Romney had more support.
No, not more
some,
support. More
some.
More support than I would have
imagined.
There were people who said they thought he was good for one reason or another.
Yeah, so I was at an election party in Udalco in the student district at a lovely little cafe called The Bridge. And there were a group of Chinese students sitting next to me. They had been sort of press ganged into showing up as a sort of American civics lesson by their English teacher. They were incredibly, first of all, uninterested, totally apathetic, had no preference whatsoever between the candidates, had never heard of the Electoral College. It was kind of an amazing.
I was actually going to say in response to your question, I was a little bit, I have encountered apathy as well. I wouldn't say there was strong interest.
Right.
No, I agree.
And so I wasn't sure how to answer your question. I mean, a few friends who are more internationalized were rooting for Obama, and I think that's part of the whole sort of global kind of interest in the United States not tilting to the, kind of extremist
right.
Right. But
otherwise,
other than that, I ran into apathy.
You're absolutely right. I think people are like, it's not going to affect me. I couldn't give a shit. I mean, often really the same reaction one hears about the selection 2012
exactly.
That's taking place in Beijing
interesting
right
parallels.
Now.
I mean, I think it might be reflects a disaffection here with all sorts of entrenched elites. Anyway,
you might have seen Simonan's comment.
I didn't know. What did Simonan have to say?
Simonan just went on about how the American election is all about, tax. Whether taxes will be higher or lower, or big government or small government, or gay rights, or he said basically all these are trivial issues. You know, China's election is about the future of China.
I see, right.
The path that China will take.
Well, I mean, he's got a point in some ways, right? I mean, you know, Hu Jintao today was talking about...
America has an institutionalized
green energy,
so.
What wasn't he? You were at the Shibata thing today. Wasn't Hu Jintao going on about green economy and stuff like that?
I thought it was almost entirely bromides. I mean, it was...
It was all bromides.
Right, but, what we have in Obama's acceptance speech, but...
Hope.
Yeah.
Bromides.
Renewed bromides.
More Hopi. What did Sarah Palin call it? Hopi changey stuff?
So my experience today.
I miss her, by the way.
I was at a certain large Chinese internet company today where that internet company had invited.
You mean the one you work at?
a former American congressman to come and give sort of a post-game analysis of the U.S. election.
Or a woman?
A guy, a former Oregon congressman, who happens also to be ethnically Chinese. David Wu, we're talking about, of course, we started off the conversation. I sort of asked the audience, how many of you here would have voted for Governor Romney if you had been able to vote in the U.S. presidential election? And not a single hand went off up, and there were just sort of a lot of snickers. I said, and what about President Obama? And I'd say 70% of the hands went up. And I'd say, what about the rest of you? They simply said, we don't really know enough about either of them to have delivered a good opinion. let me move on to our second, of course, important topic, which of course is the what are we calling it? The selection.
Selection 2012.
That's how the Colbert Report.
That's how kind of
calls the 18th Party Congress.
Gotti, what's it been like for journalists so far who've been covering the Party Congress? What's it like on the ground? I mean, has the whole...
Well, we just had the first day today, right. And a bunch of the usual suspects, including myself, filed in this morning and proceeded to participate in the pomp and circumstance by witnessing it. It was as you expect. At promptly at 9 a.m. On the opening day, Hu followed closely behind by Jiang Zemin and the others walk in and shake the relevant hands and take their seats. And Jiang Zemin, as he was 5 years ago, was front and center right next to Hu Jintao.
That's very interesting because, I mean, the Times, of course, ran a piece today talking about Jiang Zemin reasserting himself at the 18th Party Congress. And in the
Times... It's also the subject of my story that will be out by the time that people are listening to
it. Good. Do you want to give us a quick précis on what you said?
Yeah, basically...
don't let that stop anyone from subscribing to The Economist to read
indeed.
The full thing.
At economist.com. The précis is very similar, actually. I did not know the Times was working on their story, but it makes sense. I mean... There's so much noise about Jiang Zemin's influence, which is amazing, 10 years after he's out of power. I mean, it's not amazing when you really think about the history of Chinese politics.
That's right.
But some people did, underestimate Jiang. He's proved himself to be a canny operator. He installed a bunch of his people 10 years ago, and they're still around. A number of people 5 years ago were promoted that owe their careers to him as well. And he seems to be reaping the benefits now. He still has quite a bit of influence and has quite a hand, apparently, in selecting this upcoming standing committee.
5 out of 7 is what the Times is saying now.
I have the same list.
You have the same list.
But, who knows whether it's accurate. But it's a list I've heard as well. And it's also now a list that I'm seeing in some overseas media, in some of the overseas media.
So what's the thesis?
Chinese media, that
is. I mean, people are suggesting maybe that he's the new Deng. Jiang is the new Deng.
Well, no one suggests that he has the charisma or authority.
No, not the charisma, but I mean, there are parallels to be drawn. I mean, and does this perhaps betoken a chance at a 1992 Southern Tour moment by another octogenarian?
I doubt it. I mean, his symbolism is much more prosaic than that. I mean, Jiang has showed up in public a couple times, at the Beijing Opera. He's...
health may not take a southern tour.
I think, and some people interpret his public appearances differently. They suggest that someone of Deng's real power wouldn't need to kind of put themselves out there. So there are different interpretations.
Yeah, nobody has ever called Deng a paramount leader, right?
Right.
Whereas that used to be the standard phrase in the Western media
right.
to describe Deng.
Right. Right. And that, of course, made great at Deng and his ego.
So what's his agenda? I mean, what is he pushing right now?
This is the big question. I mean, the Times floated the idea, which I think is an idea that probably comes from Deng's camp, that his people now more free of the constraints of the who, when administration will be able to implement more market-oriented reforms.
Push back the advance of the SOEs.
But I don't know that you're going to see anything like that. And I think there's a lot of competing interests here. And it's very unclear what Deng's people will represent. And the Times story does sort of hedge and acknowledge that.
Right. Right.
So I think the big picture here, and what's the précis of my story, is that what this represents is that there's, aside from whatever numbers there are on the standing committee next week, there's a lot of other interests who have a lot of power. People who are, you know, there's the SOEs, there's the military, there's princelings, there's retired leaders, all sorts of, you know, quote unquote vested interests who will make it very difficult and constrain Xi Jinping. And we don't even know what Xi Jinping would really want if he had a free hand, but it's quite clear that he doesn't have a free hand.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And are we now certain that it's going to be 7 and not 9?
We can't be 100% certain of anything. Right. I mean, I think 7 is the number everybody's talking about. But even this morning, you know, some people were gossiping in the hallway at the, you know, the Great Hall of the People. And so I just heard today from someone who has military sources that, you know, Wang Yang and Li Yuanqiao, who are not on either of the lists we
right.
just mentioned, you know, people who have viewed as being more open to reform, supposedly whatever reform means, are going to be in the standing committee. But, you know, who knows? We'll find out. We'll find out now on November 15th.
Okay. So Benjamin Kong Lim from Reuters had a piece suggesting that this party congress would introduce significantly greater intra-party democracy. So Gadi, what do you think of this? Is it true? Is it really significant? And why or why not?
Well, I'm skeptical of there were two pieces of that. One is that there'll be a much larger slate for the Central Committee, for choosing the Central Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, it's been less than 10%, you know, excess candidates. Than for seats, which is not much democracy at all. I think that the Ben Lim story had 40% as
right.
a possible number for that. That seems astoundingly high to me, and it would be quite a surprise.
And for the Politburo?
And for the Politburo, the number was as high as 20% excess. In other words, 30 for 25 seats.
Yeah.
It would be the first time that there had been more candidates than seats.
Five guys who wouldn't get a chair to sit
and
down when the music
stopped. I find that quite hard to see how that would work because
I don't think people remember like what democratic centralism means. I mean,
right.
this is
top
what
down.
When
top
they
down.
Say democracy, it,
right.
they mean democratic centralism,
right.
which means.
Well, I mean, democratic
you
centralism has a very specific meaning. It simply means that there can be debate before, but once a decision is taken, everyone has to toe the line.
But
that's the theoretical meaning. But the way it's used by dictators is that I dictate and you shut up, basically. you know, that it's top down. And I don't see any sign of anybody trying to overturn that.
No, I'm skeptical that there'll be anything extensive. And I don't think that there'll be a real vote for Politburo members. I think that introduces issues about the incumbent members. And, I mean, would you vote for only the people who are newly added, or would you have a slate that's sort of encouraged? I mean, it's quite – I would say it's problematic and difficult to implement. Having more seats for the Central Committee is a little bit easier to see happening.
Even
but not,
if it's as much as 40%.
But not I would bet against 40% personally. I think that's – that would be a very high number.
In any case, I mean, a very interesting development if it does – turn out to be true.
Right.
So let's assume that it is. Is there any – what's the significance? Is this a significant move in the direction of introducing democracy not just within the upper echelons of the party and not just, you know, from the bottom, from the county level and below, but what about for the mid-tier?
You mean still inter-party
right,
democracy?
Still, yeah, of course. I mean, one can only go so far.
Well, it would be a significant step if there was actually more candidates and seats for the Politburo. Certainly. It would be a – But in what kind of what is the grander sort of context here? I mean, I wouldn't call it mind-blowing.
Okay.
It would be interesting, and it would indicate that perhaps this was one way to resolve conflicts at that level.
Come on, let's be straight. They're not going to make any meaningful reforms to the way the place is governed at this f***ing meeting.
I agree.
Whatever they say, it's a bunch of they may have reformists in place who will reform over the next 8 years, but nothing meaningful is going to happen at this meeting.
I agree with that. I believe I just said that just in more sort of elliptical, longer words,
better words.
right.
Actually,
right.
We're very clear speakers at the
Jeremy is not constrained by such things, and it's very funny because I'm not used to being
inappropriate language.
The straight man in any kind of a coupling here, but here I am, the straight man and with Jeremy. Anyway, it's a good time also, of course, to look back at the legacy of the who and when period over the last decade. Well, this is a big topic, but you know, how will the period be remembered? I mean, what have they done well? What have they utterly blown? I mean, what do you think historians writing about them 20 years from now are going to say?
Wow. 20 years from now is a...
Okay, 20 years is arbitrary.
If I may, let me try and answer that because I've actually been thinking about exactly that based on two articles which I recommend, maybe also as my recommendation at the end of the show, but for now. One is the 10 grave problems facing China, which is... the middle part of a three-part essay by Deng Yuwen, the editor of a party school journal, which is on the China Story website that I'm associated with.
Was that the
with.
One Jeremy Barmé translated?
He introduced it, and I think actually Eric from Dunway translated it.
Oh, okay.
And so these 10 problems, I mean, it's the usual list in a way. It's no meaningful political reform, not building a middle class, not building consumer society, environmental problems, over-reliance on police state tactics. It's basically the same stuff you see written about in many Western media reports, but also increasingly in China. And it looks at really the failures of the Hu Wen administration. The first part of the essay, of course, is an encomium to the 10 golden years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really something that, in 20 years' time, people might still read.
I think that's what people are thinking now. 20 years from now, you could be looking at some of the last guardians of an old way of thinking.
Maybe.
I'm thinking more sort of that there could be more completely dynamic shifts that – we'll be dealing with 20 years.
Well, let's reel that in and just say, five.
But sorry, let me. I wasn't finished because I think the other thing, the other article worth mentioning is by our frequent Seneca guest, Tanya Branigan, which looks at the slow but steady and real buildup of welfare services in China, primarily healthcare, that has actually happened.
Yes, we've written about that as well. I mean, Simon Cox for us out of Hong Kong did a very nice piece about this. They built a real
social safety
beginning.
Net.
Yeah. I would say beginning is a key word there of a safety net. I mean, it's still extremely weakly funded, very weakly funded. I mean, so to say that 95% of people are now provided with some sort of health coverage is both true, but also not really explaining the whole picture.
Sure.
And people are still easily bankrupted by a major disease. That's something that they're looking at trying to do something about, which would be another great improvement. And so they've built the platform upon which they need to improve, which is definitely more than was there 10 years ago. So that is one good thing.
There job all care. Yeah.
There are still many problems. I mean, in terms of the pension.
And if things go really south in the next couple of years, which certain economists and writers and thinkers are predicting, then that will cast a very different light on the Hu Wen administration.
And there's also a lack of portability to these schemes that's kind of makes it extremely useless.
What do you mean by that?
To like migrant workers, like their
healthcare.
They're tied to a place of
things,
and pension, and they're tied to their to where they live.
And that's one of the problems.
Or where they're working at that moment, in the case of Social Security. But if people change jobs, it's not clear what's going to happen to their benefits.
And the hukou reform is one of the problems.
They don't have much faith in them. In fact, many migrant workers don't want to be admitted into that scheme. They resist that
because it ties them to.
Well, it affects their compensation because it costs more for the employer.
Sure. I mean, and we actually, as employees, have to cover some of the costs as well.
Right. But for them, they see it as not necessarily a great deal because they may not stay at that, you know, that factory or that employer.
That's right.
So there are problems. I mean, these are all things that, I mean, exist because they've now expanded the safety net. So we have to give them credit for that.
What about addressing the famous Sennong problem? I mean, I think that one of the things that I can unequivocally say was a good thing was the reform of the agricultural tax. I mean, they abolished this 2000 years.
Yeah, but that's also been replaced with other issues like, land grabs. I mean, became much more aggressive because still local governments still need to find a way to fund themselves. It's not like you take away the land tax and they're replacing it with nothing. They're going to get their pound of flesh. And I think that the land grabs issue has actually gotten worse under who and when. Much worse.
Okay. I mean, any other legacy that you want to address from the who and years? I mean, they came in 2003, the age of SARS. I think there was a great deal of promise initially. What about from, you know, sort of the public intellectuals? Are you what's the general feel? Jeremy, your sense of the general feeling about how the administration has handled things?
Well, if one follows the usual suspects on either side of the argument, one gets, you know, the argument you would expect, by which I mean that the more nationalist kind of public intellectuals, the people who support the party generally, tend to be positive. The rightists or liberals or universal values crowd or whatever you call them tend to be very gloomy right now. I think there's a sense of crisis amongst a lot of public intellectuals in the
direction
of China.
Of course, Maoists are gloomy too on the other side.
Sure.
Maoists are
always gloomy.
Too. Yeah, Maoists are gloomy.
What would you identify as the chief challenges that they've really faced during this time? I mean, things that have happened, I mean, in such fast-changing society, things that they hadn't anticipated.
Well, I would say things that they hadn't anticipated. I was going to say the biggest challenge they faced is still there, which is inequality and a sense of deep sense of unfairness.
Sure.
And on that, I wanted to kind of tack on the hukou issue that I don't think we really mentioned.
I was trying to interrupt you, but you just never let me.
I mean,
that is the classic issue. The hukou issue, I think, is one of the great issues that the Hun administration did nothing about.
They kicked the can on it.
They kicked
the
can.
And it's actually, there's so many hidden costs. If they wanted to reform it, they have to then invest much more in the cities than they have in terms of services, schools. I mean, they'd have to do things that they've gotten away with completely ignoring for 10 years that are major challenges, major costs.
I mean, there are other costs to reforming the hukou system as well. I mean, what happens to agricultural land? I mean, are they okay with? I mean, as in some counties in Hunan, for example, and in Hubei, where single families now own 90% or more of the land in a given village. Are they okay with that? Are they okay with that kind of income inequality?
Well, that is
arising?
Happening without hukou reform. I mean, right? I mean, so.
Well, I mean, this is it would only sort of give more incentive to urban migration.
I think if you actually did real land reform and gave peasants, gave folks in the countryside.
Folks in the countryside.
I've been watching a little bit too much of the American election. We got to give those folks in the countryside their land, the rights to their land.
Their land. Buy and sell their land.
Right.
Yeah.
What about, I mean, the huge issue, of course, I think that most people are aware of is in the last 10 years we've seen this absolute revolution in telecommunications with, you know, the rise of the internet as a de facto public sphere in Chinese life, you know, beginning with the rise of bloggers in 2002, 2003 when they were just coming into office.
Or even just the use of the internet,
sure,
right?
Sure, the use of the internet.
I just was seeing a stat the last time, this is when the New York Times was blocked recently for a certain story about a certain member of the standing committee.
Who has a certain amount of money?
Yeah.
Not.
I saw this stat about in September of 2001 or something, when the last time the New York Times was site was still blocked. there were 20 million users of the internet.
538 million as of the middle of 2012.
That is transformative.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you think that they were intellectually equipped to handle that revolution?
Intellectually equipped, yes. I mean, they realize the challenge that faced them, and they've worked very aggressively, I think, at internet management.
I mean, if you read the essay by Sung Ye and Jeremy Bame written for Wired magazine in 1997, which was the first time the word Great Firewall was used about the internet, it basically talks about how they knew what was coming and they prepared for it. And as a result, I mean,
they've done well enough.
Very well.
But I mean, I think it does increase the challenge for them, and I think that the advent of social media has really increased pressure.
Has it also made them more responsive or less responsive to public opinion?
Definitely more responsive.
More responsive, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, the public opinion now exists.
It is a factor. Yeah. It's a factor in government decision making in many cases.
And do you think that you know, just asking for a really kind of quick and dirty answer here, but has it made them more or less resilient?
This term, adaptive authoritarianism. Sorry, that was Jeremy's stomach, I think, that just made an electronic noise. So they've certainly adapted, and I don't know whether it's made them more resilient or not. I mean, that's kind of a tricky question.
I don't know how to answer that either. Right. I think they have proved their resilience by their very advanced and sophisticated control of the Chinese internet that is unequaled. I mean, if you are a Machiavellian observer of strategies, the Chinese government has done a superb job in
Kaiser's stomach just made an electronic noise. I don't know what that.
They've done a superb job in
they don't like us talking about this.
So. No, I guess not. allowing the internet to be a really dynamic economic force and not let China slip behind the rest of the world, but still maintain an extraordinary degree of control.
Jeremy, you know, you've often talked about the cynicism that seems to pervade so much of Chinese political and intellectual life, and talked about what I really mean to say is that you've exhibited in kind of a concentrated and exaggerated form, taken it on and fully embodied that cynicism. Anyway, would you say that cynicism has created apathy, or has it created kind of a corpus of real activists? There's considerable cynicism, I would say, directed also toward those who would take a more active role in engage critically in politics in China. Does cynicism lead to activism, or does it lead to apathy in China?
I think it tends to lead to apathy rather than activism.
So you don't think it's drying the tinder, as it were? It's actually sort of...
Well, I think that the fact that such a lot of people are so cynical, and particularly, say, the average Weibo user, means that if the shit hits the fan, there could be a real problem because of these people who are rather disaffected. But I don't think that they will. Their cynicism will encourage them to go to the barricades.
I think there's a big question here of whether they feel, at what moment do they feel empowered, right? Mm-hmm. So when a movement happens, then there's more of an inclination to think that by doing something, you might be making a difference. But in the absence of that, I think apathy is, more often wins the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people, though, and I definitely run into them. I mean, rights awareness is so much on the rise throughout the country. Mm-hmm. So some percentage of people turn that into activism.
But it doesn't seem sort of like a narrowly construed rights awareness. I mean, it's sort of like, we see most visibly the NIMBY protests.
And particularly PX, which is the one thing you're allowed to protest against if you are in a well-off city. Yeah. Then you can make a protest against PX.
Well, it's construed towards factory. It's always construed towards local concerns. I mean, it's at the most local level. It's, you don't like your village party, your village chief or your village party secretary. Well, now there are some people who will take that.
And take action.
Take action in some ways, and they'll figure out a way to do it. You know, I did a story about a month ago about this farmer in Hebei who, he's now on Weixin.
Oh, I saw this.
And he, he's made contacts with journalists, and he did this with no particular level of sophistication other than he became increasingly aware of his rights, and his family had been at odds with the leadership of his village even as it changed for a half century until now, basically. So, but for the first 30, 40 years, made no progress. But as corruption became an issue and as money came in, more and more villagers were dissatisfied. And when he would reach out to a reporter, and it was a state media reporter, it would be like Xinhua or some other state media reporter at first, and eventually people like Wang Keqin or his colleagues, you know, investigative reporters. And they would come, and then they would do a story, and then that would put some pressure. And you know, he uses these contacts, and now the fact that he even has these contacts is sort of a check against his, you know, his local kind of oppressors, as he sees it. And he's won some victories, and this kind of activist didn't exist, you know, maybe before 10 years ago. It's certainly not in these kind of numbers. I think there's more and more people who, in part because of the party's own rhetoric about rule of law and about, you know, rights, property rights, human rights, in part because of their own rhetoric, people have become more aware.
I think there's a lot of people who are approaching the stage of being madder than hell, and they ain't going to take it anymore.
Absolutely.
And now they have a platform to, you know, they don't have to be working at a broadcast.
Right, network. And that manifests in the things like the PX plant,
yeah.
Or land grabs, et cetera.
Okay.
So not just apathy. There's lots of other things going on too.
I think you're apathetic until, you know, you get screwed.
Until you get really screwed, right. And then you get pissed. Yeah.
I wanted to ask one more question of Gotti here. What should we be watching as sort of the casual China watcher to come out of this party Congress? What sort of you know, dog whistles should we be listening for?
Well, Jeremy is right that we're not going to see any sort of signals of reform from this Congress. I mean, the one thing that people will be watching is the lineup of the new standing committee. That's the one sort of visible thing that you can hold on to, you can latch on to. And that will be on November 15th, right after the first plenum of the Central Committee of the 18th Central Committee. And if that list is, as let's say I wrote about and as some others have written about, then that means it's a heavily Jiang Zemin influenced list.
Mm-hmm.
But we still don't even know what the implications of that would be.
You know?
I mean, as I just mentioned, the New York Times story has different interpretations of whether that signals hope for more reforms or not. My view is that regardless of what happens next Thursday, the overlapping and competing interests that exist off of the standing committee make it very difficult for, you know, ambitious reforms.
Are we going to be counting mentions of Mao Zedong thought?
I think Mao Zedong thought is alive and well, and you saw that in the speech.
What a load of bollocks these people saying, yeah. No Mao Zedong thought. I mean, really, for f**k's sake, go to Tiananmen Square and look like what's hanging on Tiananmen and then look south and see what's in the middle of this fucking square. I mean, please, what a ridiculous notion.
Well, you know, Jeremy. Lenin is still, you know, still in Red Square, right?
Not the same.
But I do agree.
He ain't on the money.
I do agree we're not going to see Mao Zedong thought going anywhere.
Okay, guys. Let's move now into the section where we make recommendations. I think there's just an incredible amount of stuff to recommend this week for people who are watching the Party Congress. I guess one really good place to start, and I'm just going to jump in. I'm going to do another recommendation later, but is that whole batch of pieces on foreign policy. A very big section. I mean, it's got everyone from Willie Lamb to Ken Lieberthal to our friend Kathleen McLaughlin. Some older pieces, including like a critique of Xi Jinping by Yu Jie, and a very, very pessimistic piece by Min Xinpei, surprise, suggesting that, you know, rather than worrying about the rise of China, we ought be worrying about its collapse. There's also a similarly pessimistic piece by Perry Link that actually goes back to June of this year that posits that China's post-89 model has run out of steam. So that's really good. That's a really good collection of stuff to read. I mean, it'll keep you busy for a whole morning. And then the other one that I would recommend is another person who's appeared on this show before, Damian Ma. He wrote a really good piece. It's quite thoughtful and really accessible to it's called Before and After Who. Is China Better Off Than It Was 10 Years Ago? And it's in Foreign Affairs, and it's not firewalled. So I will put a link to that up on the site. These are not my official recommendations for the week. I have another one up my sleeve, but let's go to Gotti.
You're kind of cheating there.
I'm packing in a bunch
things?
Of recommendations.
Well, I'm just going to recommend one China read and one non-China. Non-China reads are allowed as well.
Yeah, they sure are.
Actually, I haven't read the non-China read yet, so I'm really cheating.
That's okay.
I just bought it. The China Read is the new Mao biography by Alexander Pantsov. Well, it's newly translated.
I want the guy who wants to make crank calls at age 13 has.
Thanks, Bart Simpson. Alexander Pantsov. and by Stephen Levine, it's actually about a 4 or 5 year old biography but it was in Russian and it's just been translated and it's a great read. I'm only, you know, a bit into it. Not yet gotten to the first Party Congress.
Wow.
But I think it's terrific. And for people who remember the Cheng Holiday book. From like about 7 years ago, the people were sort of concerned about its reliability. This is another chance to go at a new reading of Mao that includes a lot more from Soviet archives.
Oh, good.
So that's great.
Yeah, that's been on my list for a while now. I need to get to it.
And then the non-China read, a rather obscure perhaps, but it's by a former Baltimore Sun foreign correspondent, long departed, William Manchester. The third volume of his magisterial Winston Churchill biography, finished by somebody else,
right.
It's called The Last Lion. And this one's kind of takes you from Dunkirk until the end of Churchill's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 1,000-page thing that I plan to read over Christmas.
Oh,
just out. It's like, you know, the last Christmas. Volume came out in 1988. So there was.
He means Hanukkah.
Some people were. Yeah. Christmas. It's America. It's like, you know.
What are you going to read before Kwanzaa?
Yeah, because you know we Africans we all celebrate Kwanzaa. I have a few things. I'd just like to say again the 10 grave problems facing China, the Deng Yuan piece on the China story.
Is that the one with the five vermin in it?
No, that's another one, which I think you should read together, five vermin facing China, another piece by another influential Chinese think tanker about the five dangerous kind of the dangers to China's stability.
Lawyers.
Rights lawyers, activists, internet leaders. What's the fourth one?
I think it was like
the one that has basically pissed everybody off is.
Let's Jeremy get
that's,
that.
That's a good sign.
I wanted to bring up it was Zhong Chang's and Halliday's Mao the Unknown Story is
right.
The book I'm mentioning,
right.
And the reason some people thought that there's just tons of like kind of not necessarily well sourced.
Unbelievable.
I'm really sorry about that. That's going to require some editing.
No, I think we can just go straight through it.
I'll just breeze through it. That's
sorry.
We get
about
phone calls.
But anyways, go back to it.
So yeah, so then the other piece is the five vermin facing China. Where did I get to?
You were talking about, okay, so we had lawyers, rights lawyers, internet leaders.
So it's rights lawyers, internet leaders, activists. I don't remember the fourth one, but the fifth one is Rorschach 20, like weak
like
groups
weak
in
groups.
Society,
right.
Which you know caused a lot of people to say Rorschach this is 20. The new Black Five categories, Xin Hei Wu Lei, and Jeremy Barmé translated it and also compared it to Han Feizi's Wu Du, the five vermin facing China.
Poisons, right.
Very interesting. And then Tanya Barnigan's piece about the... social
safety net
in China. Finally, one non-China read, the Baffler magazine, has a website. And I don't know if you know the Bafflers.
I've never heard of it.
It's great writing. And there are two pieces that are free on their website. One is looking at how Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert are kind of actually basically just completely establishment figures despite their reputation and that they're kind of sellouts, which, I mean, you know, it's sort
nonsense.
Of a contrarian point of view and well-written. Another piece about why aren't there flying cars? Why don't we have this is the year 2000 that we were promised when we were children.
I want to know about why don't we have flying cars?
Where's my jetpack?
Well, yeah, read the Baffler magazine.
Okay, to find those answers. I'm going to recommend something that I think maybe possibly ties the two topics that we're looking at today. I mean, it's something I've been thinking about quite a lot. It's called Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy by Christopher Hayes. I'm about four chapters into it. It's a fairly slim volume, but it's really, really, really good. The guy, I mean, possesses this pretty formidable erudition, and the argument that he makes is fascinating. He talking about how meritocracy in America is essentially broken. I mean, and some of the points that he's raised so far just are fascinating. It, you know, he talks about how, well, essentially, the Tea Party and the Occupy movement are both sort of expressions of this, you know.
Is this a coded attack, Kaiser, on my Banyan column about a couple weeks ago about meritocracy, about the fallacy of Chinese meritocracy?
Right. So this is where I was going with this.
Is this a two-line struggle developing here?
This is a two-line struggle. So the thing that, of course, I've been thinking is that, you know, we're seeing the same thing happen in China, this massive disaffection with the winners in the meritocratic game. You know, since reform and opening began, it was essentially some people will get rich before others. There's been all this allowance for inequality.
Let me be Jeremy Goldcorn for a second and just say that's because the meritocratic game here is a joke. It's not it's not meritocratic.
Right. Well, that's essentially what he says about meritocracy. We cling to it, but it's actually a false premise now. We are not, in fact, a meritocracy in America.
Let's use data here. I mean, one of my colleagues, not to trumpet yet another economist piece, but Zanny Mitten-Beddoes of The Economist, who's a very fine writer for us on the economy, on the global, wrote a piece about global inequality, wrote a special report about global inequality. And one of the interesting things to look at is whether you do better than your parents or whether your parents' income determines yours. China does very poorly on that scale and worse than the U.S. And the U.S. doesn't do great by comparison to, like, you know, Scandinavian countries. It's surprisingly weak.
Mobility.
That sort of supports partly your thesis. But I think the U.S. is certainly more meritocratic than
sure,
China.
Sure.
There's certainly more social mobility.
Isn't China, you know, compared to the United States? That's not the point that I'm trying to make.
I'm just trying to respond to the challenge of the coda attack.
Suggesting – no, there really wasn't any intended. Mobility index, though, for Americans has decreased incredibly. I mean,
it's been really
shocking.
It's been a bad couple of decades.
Yeah, it has been a very, very bad couple of decades.
It's
fascinating. I really highly recommend you read it. I mean, one thing that has been gnawing at me watching the election yesterday, we've done well on progressives have done well on issues where inclusion is the factor. I mean, we've made great advancements in gay rights, in civil rights. I mean, you cannot any longer be an overt racist in American politics. You can't be an overt sexist in American politics. I mean, we saw Aiken go down, and we saw Moorcock go down, Moorlach,
and several others who made kooky statements,
right, kooky statements
about.
Rape
and abortion.
Well, we've made tremendous strides in these things, but this is because they are essentially issues of meritocracy. I mean, this is where the left and the right converge. We both believe in
judging people by their skills rather than by their character.
But where meritocracy doesn't. I mean, this is just basically establishing that this is really an integral part of our political culture. I mean, really, since the 1960s, it has been. But.
And I would say that visit freerepublic.com. You know, it's a right-wing American website, which is sort of interesting for an insight into Tea Party-type people. And some of the reactions to the Obama win I found interesting, particularly discussions about, you know, how screwed up things would be under Obama for the next 4 years and America's ending. But there were quite a few commenters who pointed out that intrusions into Americans' personal lives are basically not acceptable anymore. So basically pointing out that the kind of rape statements, wanting to, you know, criminalize or make life difficult for homosexuals, this kind of thing just isn't going to fly anymore. And freerepublic.com is one of those websites that one might describe as a wingnut website. I mean, it's Tea Party people. And even within the Tea Party, there seems to be some...
And you were looking at this out of some sort of masochistic enterprise.
It's kind of Schadenfreude, really, actually.
I've indulged in a little bit of that. I'm sort of,
let's go see what the right-wingers are saying.
Let's see how they're eating each other now. Anyway, thanks, Gotti. Thanks for coming on. And enjoy
Kaiser.
The rest of the Party Congress, Jerry.
Yeah, have a blast, Gotti. I know, it's going to be really exciting stuff.
Yeah, I heard parties are just insane, man.
Right. And I'd like to apologize to all our listeners for the unprecedented levels of profanity and on the show.
We love you, Jeremy.
Why are you... fucking apologize.
All right. Good night, and we will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.